I'm Jim Falzarano, and this is Guardian Daily for Thursday, the 28th of May. Coming up in today's podcast, the head of Amnesty International says the credit crunch is a disaster for human rights.
Human rights is taking a hit. The World Bank says 53 million people will be affected by the economic crisis, pushed back into poverty.
And North Korea ratchets up the tension.
North Korea has restarted, or at least is preparing to restart, its biggest nuclear reactor, its nuclear plant, the Yongbyon.
Plus, is there a rocky road ahead for Obama's Supreme Court nominee? But first, a look at the headlines and today's papers with Bill Overton.
The Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg says MPs should be barred from taking their summer break until the constitutional crisis sparked by the expenses row is resolved. In today's Guardian, he's insisting Parliament shouldn't be allowed to go into recess until every nook and cranny of the political system is reformed. The Lib Dem leader set out a 100-day action plan. Some of his suggestions include making it possible for MPs to be sacked by their constituents, abolishing the House of Lords, getting corrupt money out of politics, and changing the electoral system to give a voice to everyone. More revelations at the end of the third week of the MPs' expenses scandal. Anger's growing over Tory backbencher Julie Kirkbride's claims. The Bromsgrove MP broke cover to defend her position last night after David Cameron warned she had questions to answer. But she was pushed deeper into trouble by revelations taxpayers part-funded a £50,000 extension at her flat so her brother could live there. She insists the extra bedroom was needed because it was inappropriate for her young son to share with his uncle, who was carrying out childcare duties. And the Tory grandee, Sir John Butterfield, is the latest subject today after avoiding capital gains tax on £600,000 profit from selling a taxpayer-funded property. He claimed nearly £17,000 just for servants' quarters, where his housekeeper and odd-job man lived. The Obama administration's told Israel to stop expanding Jewish settlements without exception. The message from the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is the strongest yet from Washington. Mrs. Clinton revealed that at a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Obama said he wants to see a stop to settlements. Not some settlements, not outposts, not natural growth exemptions. She made her comments at a joint press conference with the Egyptian Foreign Minister. She promised Washington would push this point with its ally. Mr. Netanyahu has said natural growth will continue. A group of top musicians, including members of Blur and Pink Floyd, are demanding the British National Party stop selling their music to raise campaign funds. The far-right party is selling a range of folk albums on its website, but many of the musicians featured claim they're powerless to stop their work financing the party. Billy Bragg, drummers Dave Rowntree from Blur and Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, have teamed up with the Musicians Union and featured Artists Coalition, saying they object to the BNP's politics and morals. The BNP's commercial partner Excalibur sells a range of compilation CDs with titles such as Proud Heritage, Rule Britannia and The White Cliffs of Dover. Now sport, Manchester United fans are making the long journey home today after watching their team fail in its attempts to clinch back-to-back Champions League titles. United were comprehensively beaten by a skillful Barcelona side in Rome's Stadio Olimpico last night. Two well-taken goals clinched the win for the Spanish team. Samuel Eto'o's slid one past Van der Sar 10 minutes into the first half, and a header from Lionel Messi at 70 minutes in the second half secured victory for Barcelona. The Man U manager, Sir Alex Ferguson, says his team's defence last night was shoddy.
I think that losing the first goal didn't help, that's for sure. And it gave them the opportunity to keep their possession, which they do very well. And also we didn't plan to lose a goal as early as that. But it was a fact and we didn't deal with it well enough. So I think that that really is the story.
Around 20,000 fans packed into the stadium and a further 10,000 ticketless supporters were estimated to have travelled to Rome for the game. The Manchester United team are expected back at the city's airport today and, despite the defeat, expecting a warm welcome from fans. And now look at the headlines. It's all gone horribly wrong, moans The Sun over a picture of a dejected-looking Cristiano Ronaldo, while The Times declares Barcelona's Lionel Messi the king of Europe. The Daily Mail is thankful that at least one royal is chummy with the French, next to a photograph of Prince William smiling alongside European football's French president Michel Platini. The picture is published as a foil to the Mail's cover story that the French have bowed to public pressure and invited the Queen to D-Day celebrations after announcing they'd never planned to invite members of the British royal family. The Times delves into what it calls the mystery of the BNP war chest as it reveals that the British National Party's leader Nick Griffin paid £5,000 of political donations into his own bank account. Julie Kirkbride's expenses claim for a £50,000 extension is the latest front-page revelation from the ongoing Daily Telegraph investigation. And from the FT, the beleaguered US carmaker GM's anger over the political manoeuvring in Europe. Finally, Britain's Got Talent sensation Susan Boyle let it rip first in a hotel lobby after a couple of people tried to wind her up, and then on the London policeman who intervened. She was heard spouting four-letter abuse, which earns her the nickname Ramboyle, on the front page of the Daily Mail. And those are the headlines today. More news updated throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Amnesty International's Secretary General says that world leaders are neglecting deadly conflicts that were, quote, spawning massive human rights abuses. The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Julian Borger, speaks with Irene Khan.
We see the breakdown of an economic system. And so a lot of attention focusing on fixing the economic system and forgetting that there is also a human rights crisis, both linked to that system and aggravated by that system.
So the credit crunch has had a direct impact on human rights?
Of course. If you look at it in very simple terms, it's affecting people's ability to meet basic needs. Now, it's leading when export-oriented economies are being hit by it, workers are being laid off, migrant workers are being sent home, and that's having an impact in countries like Bangladesh, Mexico, Philippines. That's then leading internally to sometimes social tensions, to loss of revenue on the part of some of these governments because of fall of remittances, and that affects then the social services that these people would have the poorest people would have relied on. So we actually see a direct impact from it, if you follow the trail, hitting the poorest badly. We also see other types of indirect impacts. We've seen, for instance, in parts of Africa, in Benin, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, where people have protested, they are being treated, you know, the response has been very harsh. Tunisia, where two people were killed last year during the labor unrest.
So would you say, looking across the world, and I know it's very difficult to aggregate these things, but looking across the planet, that as the world economy has gone into recession, human rights has already also taken a dive?
Human rights is taking a hit. The World Bank says 53 million people will be affected by the economic crisis, pushed back into poverty. 120 million were affected last year with the hike of food prices. And that, of course, continues to affect many, many of the poorer countries of the world. International Labour Office is talking about 18 to 50 million people losing jobs. And in most of these cases, it is the poorest that are suffering. You know, if you look at in Africa, when commodity prices are going down, it actually affects countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo and the poorest people who are working in the mines there. So you can see down the food chain, as you go down the chain, that the poorest are being hit very badly, and that's playing out in terms of economic and social rights. Many people are really very much now on the edge of survival. And in most cases, when Amnesty has documented issues of poverty, what we find is that the poorest are also the most marginalized, the most discriminated. In Latin America, which is possibly the most unequal region in the world now, if you look at who is really below the poverty line or the extreme poverty line, they tend to be the indigenous people, the isolated rural people, the Afro-Caribbeans. So discrimination, together with deprivation, is having a huge impact on the lives of these people, and very often it is linked also to insecurity.
After this week's nuclear missile tests got the world's attention, North Korea has restarted its nuclear reactor and threatened its neighbor to the south. Justin McCurry, The Guardian's Tokyo correspondent, reviews Kim Jong-il's latest round of provocations.
In the last 48 hours or so, it's launched yet more short-range missiles, which apparently landed safely in the Sea of Japan. But yesterday, it ratcheted up the pressure even more by threatening to launch an attack on its neighbour, South Korea, after the government in Seoul decided that it would take part in a US-led mission to inspect North Korean vessels that it suspects of carrying weapons of mass destruction. Now, Seoul had balked at the invitation to join this initiative. It's been around for some time, but obviously the events on the Korean Peninsula over the last few days have persuaded it that it's time that it also joined in international efforts to increase the pressure on the North.
And what about the restarting of the reactor?
Yeah, so this is, in the long term, an even bigger cause for concern. There are reports, mainly from officials from the South Korean Defense Ministry, carried in the South Korean media, that North Korea has restarted, or at least is preparing to restart, its biggest nuclear reactor, its nuclear plant, the Yongbyon nuclear plant, which it had started to dismantle in 2007 after the six-party nuclear talks looked like they were about to look like they were making some progress. There'd been a deal whereby North Korea would receive massive amounts of aid in return for dismantling its main reactor. It then threatened to restart the reactor last month after the UN condemned its long-range missile launch. Remember, in early April, it launched a Taepodong-2 long-range ballistic missile. It claims it was a satellite, but the rest of the world believes it was really a missile test. And after it was condemned for doing that, it said that it was going to walk away from the six-party talks, conduct another nuclear test, and restart its plutonium extraction program. And it seems to have done all three now.
What's the significance of North Korea saying it's no longer going to be bound by the armistice? Is that just a dispute between North and South Korea, or is this meant for international consumption?
Well, strictly speaking, it's a dispute between North and South. But as history's told us, any dispute involving the Korean Peninsula tends to draw in other regional powers. So that is a cause of concern. It could be just another slice of belligerent rhetoric from the North Koreans. They've threatened to attack the South on several occasions before over the last few years. It's never happened. They're aware of what the consequences of doing that might be. But I think, as far as I know, this is the first time that it's mentioned that it no longer wants to abide by the conditions of the armistice that ended the Korean War in 1953. But, you know, again, I think as far as North Korea is concerned, a lot of this rhetoric could... Of course, it's designed to catch the interest of the West, particularly President Obama, but it's also designed for domestic consumption. You know, as my colleagues have written in The Guardian over the last few days, Kim Jong-il's been unwell. He was thought to have suffered a stroke last summer. There's a lot of speculation about who will succeed him as leader of North Korea. And this, again, might just be just another way of letting the Korean generals in the military, hardline military, know exactly who's in charge.
Still to come, Barack Obama chooses a symbol of diversity for the U.S. Supreme Court.
Her life story is a compelling one, and, you know, one might say that shouldn't matter, but these things always do, because it's about creating a narrative, a sympathetic narrative about the person, getting them confirmed.
But first, Julian Glover, The Guardian's chief leader writer, discusses the various proposals for improving British politics. I asked him whether electoral reform is a rational response to the row over MPs' expenses.
It seems rational to the MPs. They want to move the talk away from themselves. They want to talk about the system. They want to talk about big problems in the way that people connect with politics. And they feel a lot of the anger about expenses is unjustified. They think some of the MPs have been really caught out doing pretty bad things. A lot of them, they feel, haven't done anything particularly wrong. They're very shocked by the public anger. And their diagnosis, it was very strong in a speech David Cameron gave in Milton Keynes about this, is that this isn't really about expenses, it's about people hating politics. And so if you agree with that, then it is rational to talk about reform.
Okay, so what kinds of realistic proposals might we see in the party's manifestos? Is that too much to ask?
There will be lots of language in the manifestos, but what we're getting is a whole mishmash of different ideas coming forward, some of them quite serious, some of them really wouldn't make much difference. Some, it's much more just about language. So David Cameron's speech, which is a very clever speech, but the best thing any of the party leaders has so far done on the reform issue. But nonetheless, a lot of what he talked about was the need to kind of break through power, to restrict central government, to devolve things downwards. Those are really general ideas. How to do it specifically is much harder.
Let's talk a little bit about proportional representation, because this is the idea that's been touted again and again, especially by the Lib Dems. First of all, explain how it works.
Well, there's lots of versions of proportional representation, and there's also something called electoral reform, which is changing the voting system. You don't have to make it proportional. You could change it in other ways as well. If you start from a feeling that at the current electoral system, the way people vote doesn't really reflect who gets elected, that the governments can win with big majorities like Labour in 1997, under half the vote in Britain went to Labour in 97. Nonetheless, they got a huge landslide. The Conservative Party got more votes in England at the last general election than the Labour Party did, and yet the Labour Party got 100 more MPs than the Conservatives. That doesn't really feel very democratic. If you agree with that, you've got to look at how to make the system better. And there's all sorts of different ways to do it. The Conservative Party say, keep the current voting system, but change the boundaries. They make the seats all the same size or make them bigger or smaller. One consequence of that is that the Conservative Party would do better, so they quite like that system. Labour's pretty sceptical about it because they rather like the system as it is. The Liberal Democrats and some Labour MPs say it's not enough just to fix the boundaries. You've got to really re-engineer the way people vote. And then you get into the technicalities, and it's pretty complex to explain the different systems. But each party and each enthusiast has their own model that they believe is better than anyone else's.
Now, are there other models of PR that do work? Give us some examples of that.
Well, I mean, one small country which I think is a good model for Britain is New Zealand, other side of the world, but nonetheless a political system that's quite similar. It was based on the House of Commons. They had our current system, first past the post, for many years. They had a left big party and a right big party, and one or other always won a majority government. And the public got absolutely sick of that. They forced through, almost against the will of the big parties, a change to the voting system. They got a proportional system. And now they have a much more dynamic political environment. They have six, seven, eight parties sometimes. They have coalitions in government. They've had a lot of women politicians. Supporters of PR would see that as a really good example for Britain to follow.
Now, next week we're going to have the European elections, a proportional representation system, and yet there's supposed to be quite a low turnout. Why is that? Is that necessarily a vote against PR?
Well, people don't really think the European Parliament matters. I think a lot of people who like Europe don't really feel that encouraged by voting for the Parliament, but they don't mind Britain being in the EU. People who don't like Europe don't feel voting for a European institution is really a way to kind of show their protest. So what you get is a lot of people staying at home. They don't feel it affects their taxes. They don't really know what MEPs do. And one thing is they haven't got a clue who the MEPs are. I think even if you ask party campaigners, I spoke to one on the phone just recently and said, you know, do you know who the MEP is? They didn't know. So it's a body that feels very alien. It feels distant. It's not in the news in Britain. It's very rarely reported. So it's not surprising that a lot of people don't bother to vote.
Crystal ball time. What, if any, of these proposals do you think will emerge in the next few years?
I think there'll be some tinkering inside Parliament. It'll be quite hard to understand it all, but it might strengthen the committees a bit. People talk about restraining the whips. Well, I'm not sure that will happen, and I'm not completely sure it's a good idea. I think the whip system is necessary inside Parliament. There'll be a lot of talk about PR, proportional representation, from its supporters. The Liberal Democrats are always committed to it. They have a favourite model they want. They'll probably push that a bit more publicly than they would have done otherwise. The Conservative Party will be strongly against it. And the Labour Party, I think more Labour MPs will come out in favour, or at least talk about it. A lot of the Labour MPs, though, hate PR. And in the Labour manifesto, well, it depends a bit what happens to Labour in the next year. Labour's manifesto always has a commitment to have a referendum on the electoral system or a review. It had the review, it didn't have the referendum. Maybe they'll sharpen that up. What they won't be able to do is change the system before the election. And I think lots of people, if that did happen or if they attempted to do it, would say, hang on, you're about to lose and now you're trying to rewrite the rules so you can win again.
You can join our continuing debate on electoral reform at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Elsewhere on the web, the cuckoo has joined the RSPB's red list of endangered British birds. Find out more at guardian.co.uk/environment. Full reports and analysis of last night's Champions League final from our team in Rome at guardian.co.uk/football. And find out why celebrities are getting tired of Twitter at guardian.co.uk/technology. Barack Obama nominated a Hispanic woman to the U.S. Supreme Court on the same day that California's High Court ruled on Proposition 8, which struck down gay marriage in that state. I asked Michael Tomasky, editor of Guardian America, about Sonia Sotomayor's chances of confirmation and about her possible future role in the gay marriage controversy.
I think it was a politically good pick. The first Latina, that's a big swing vote, and the political consideration should not be the main consideration, but it's fine if it's a consideration. She's got many years on the bench, so they can't argue with her experience. They can't argue with her education or pedigree. Her life story is a compelling one, and one might say that shouldn't matter, but these things always do because it's about creating a narrative, a sympathetic narrative about the person, getting them confirmed. So she was the favorite when Souter originally announced his retirement, and there are reasons she was the favorite, everything I just mentioned. So for all those reasons, I think the pick makes sense.
What kind of opposition does she face? Are the Republicans going to go easy on her?
I think they'll do a sort of division of labor. But the bottom line is that they really don't have the votes to block her. You would have to filibuster, as we call it over here, meaning that they can't pass something through the United States Senate with 40 votes. That means every single Republican would have to decide to be against her, including a few moderate Republicans who have voted with President Obama on some other measures already. That seems virtually inconceivable to everyone. So I don't think they'll try to block her. They know that they don't have the votes to block her. But when she comes up for her confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is the relevant committee here, I think she will face some very tough questioning from some Republicans. So there'll be a kind of a good cop, bad cop routine. And I think there will be a reasonably substantial number of votes against her in the end.
Now, assuming that she is confirmed, what kind of a change will she make in the balance of the court, if any?
She won't make much of a change that we can foresee at this point in the balance of the court. And the reason is this. There are 9 people on the United States Supreme Court. Lately, for the past few years, the balance has been 4 conservatives, 4 liberals, 1 person who goes back and forth. That's Anthony Kennedy. She's replacing one of the liberals and will presumably herself be a liberal. So she doesn't really alter the ideological balance of the court in any way that we can predict. And I should emphasize that because, David Souter himself ended up being a very unpredictable figure on the court, nominated by a Republican, presumed to be more conservative than not, ended up being much more liberal than not.
On the same day that Obama made his pick, the California Supreme Court ruled that Proposition 8 would stand. I wanted to get your reaction on that very controversial measure.
Well, as a matter of law, what the California court did is probably the only thing that it could do. A court has a lot of legal hurdles to jump in trying to invalidate a ballot initiative that was passed by popular will. At the same time, the court did strike a bit of a compromise by saying to the 18,000 gay and lesbian Californians who had gotten married during that brief window when gay marriage was legal in the state, that their marriages still counted and could not be invalidated by this. And I think that was a good measure as well. So, I don't think the court was in a position to do much other than what it did.
So how long do you think it will take before this issue does appear before the U.S. Supreme Court? Years, months, decades?
I would say years, but maybe not that many years. And, this is working its way through many state legislatures now. It's typically thought to be a state matter. Hence the California State Supreme Court on that decision yesterday, rather than some federal appellate court out west. States, as some of your listeners may know, such as Iowa recently legalized gay marriage, Vermont legalized it, New Hampshire voted it down by 2 votes. So it's a matter left to states and may stay within the state court system.
Vanessa Feltz, BBC Radio's distinctive morning voice, has won a Sony Radio Academy Gold for Speech Personality of the Year. G2's Hannah Poole asked her how she got her break as a presenter.
My sort of break in the me jar came when I was asked to present the Vanessa show on the telly, which was considered to be a sort of vulgar plagiarism of a vulgar American show. And that's probably absolutely exactly what it was. But it was my chance. It was the thing I was asked to do. Now, had I been asked to present a show on logical positivism, or indeed on Andrew Marvell and his fellow poets, I could have done that with equal aplomb and charisma, and I'm quite sure that it would have been a great ratings hit. But because I wasn't asked to do that, and because I wasn't asked to present the Antiques Roadshow or something about inner city urban housing decay, I think I might have been branded a vulgar, cheap tabloid person. And in many ways I am, and I don't think there's a great deal wrong with that, but I think, you know, I'm slightly more complex, as everybody is. Hope there's a little light and shade anyway.
Is there now a Radio 2 or Radio 4 job that you've got your eye on?
What can I tell you? I, as I say, the men in suits seem suddenly to have noticed me. And there are some women in suits too, some crammed into rather unforgiving and unflattering suits, who have waddled over towards me to say, you know, hello and let's say make portentous statements about things yet to come. But I'm not sure they're ready for me, and I don't know if I'm really ready for them. I do seem to have found, and I'm reluctant to say it because, you know, you never want to seem too happy and you never want to tempt the fates or the gods in any way, but I've had so many trials and tribulations and vicissitudes, maybe I'm safe to say for once, I seem to have found a place where I really do seem to fit well. You know, I am a Londoner through and through. I've lived in the same sort of 6 miles of London my entire life. I have that feeling of London being a village, because I know that if I go to get my fruit at a certain shop in Hampstead Garden suburb, they say, ah, your grandma liked a nice melon. You know, that makes you feel, you know, I sent my children to the same school that I went to. There's a certain feeling of continuity. I've never dreamed of living anywhere else. Even South London feels somewhat foreign. So the idea of leaving London and forsaking it for another locality is just so alien to me. So I you know, it fits my soul and my heart to be working at BBC London, and my geography and my inclination, and you know, I seem to gel very well with my listeners. I see them everywhere I go, all the time, and it, you know, calls out of windows and buses and whatever, you know, great show V, or loved it, or what load of rubbish you were talking this morning, or hey, what are you on, girl, don't be so stupid, or whatever it is, and so I feel, you know, it feels like a very comfortable fit, thank God.
How much of your popularity is to do with the fact, to do with your kind of, you have this image as being a survivor?
I can't quantify it. I don't know, but I do know that I have callers who say, well, V, you'll understand this. I know you've been through this, or, you know, you've been there yourself, or you know, you'll know what I mean when I say. But we're all survivors. I mean, either we're dead or we're surviving, so I don't get any prize for having survived anything. But I suppose having led this tabloid life, which I had no intention of leading, didn't mean to lead, but I seem to be a sort of, you know, cartoon tabloid figurine of rather large dimensions. And so people feel they know everything there is to know about my divorce, my weight, my children, my mother dying, or whatever it is, my career imploding. I mean, people know that it has been by no means a sort of straight trajectory of nothing but progress and pleasure. I've had some really appallingly lousy breaks and some terrible moments and some awful, you know, bleak years. It has been, you know, quite hard. And I think people relate to that because they know I'm anything but a kind of smooth and polished, perfect, size 8 person. I mean, I've had, you know, terrible times, and they know that. So I think it you know, it just makes you, I don't say it makes you seem more human, because I am human. I think it makes you maybe feel more human.
This podcast was produced by Phil Maynard, Andy Duckworth, and Roxanne Escobales. I'm Jim Falzerano. Thanks for listening.